This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Bruce Herbert, Chief Executive, and Larry Doors, Vice President of Newground Social Investment, a social purpose corporation dedicated to socially responsible investing and shareholder advocacy. Bruce and Larry were most recently guests on the sustainability segment in June of 2012 and told us about recent successes of shareholder advocacy in creating positive change in publicly traded corporations. Bruce Herbert and Larry Doors are here today to give us an update on progress made since then and to evaluate the accomplishments of shareholder advocacy in this year's 2013 proxy season. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Diane. It's great to be here again.
Thanks very much.
Would you remind us, what is socially responsible investing?
Well, socially responsible investment has often been described as a stool that has three legs. And the first leg is historically where it started, and that is called screening or avoidance. And a person who is screening a portfolio, an investment portfolio, is seeking to avoid investing in companies that are engaged in activities that they don't approve of or feel good about. And it really started with the churches back in the 1920s that decided to divest of the so-called sin stocks, the alcohol, tobacco, and gambling. The second leg of the three-leg social investment stool is community investment or microcredit lending. This is what Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for in 2006, and that is making available to communities or underserved groups of people really necessary banking services and capital access that routinely has been in short supply, if not outright denied to them. And it really creates very positive benefits on the ground in neighborhoods and in places of need. And the third leg of the stool is shareholder advocacy, what we're here to talk about today. And shareholder advocacy or shareholder engagement is actively using your rights as a shareholder to go and talk to corporate management about improving their practices, really about addressing the issues that arise almost inevitably from the operations of any large entity like a publicly traded corporation.
How widespread is socially responsible investing and who is involved?
Well, these days it's grown quite a bit, so that approximately $1 in $9 or $1 in $8 that are invested with some consciousness around, you know, what are the companies that we're owning doing? And most interestingly, a lot of the big pension funds have really come around and begun to participate because they recognize that they're very long-term investors. They're going to have to pay benefits to their beneficiaries decades from now, and they really want to be owning companies that are looking that far down the road as well. And that takes some level of social consciousness.
Would you say more about the role that shareholder advocacy plays in socially responsible investing?
Sure, Diane. An analogy that we use, people are very familiar with the familiar environmental axiom, reduce, reuse, recycle. And most people think of those as perhaps equivalent choices, but they really are not. Some of those choices have a much more beneficial impact on the ground than others. Recycling, for instance, is a necessary starting point, but it's not sufficient really to meet our long-term sustainability goals. And the reducing and reusing, on the other hand, are much more beneficial. In similar way, the three legs of the social investment stool, the screening, the community investment, and the shareholder advocacy, they also form kind of a hierarchy where screening is a starting point. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient to meet those long-term goals. The community investment really changes lives on the ground. The shareholder advocacy has the opportunity of transforming corporate behavior rather than just letting it go on unabated. And so in that way, we think of shareholder advocacy as really being one of the most important leading edges of the social investment movement.
What determines whether a shareholder proposal is placed on the ballot at an annual meeting?
Well, the rules around that are promulgated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. In the most simple form, if a shareholder has owned $2,000, and that's dollars, not shares, $2,000 worth of stock and has held it for a year, they qualify to put forward a shareholder proposal. Of course, there are a range of other requirements. A proposal has to be 500 words or less in length. It has to be germane to shareholders at large. It can't be, you know, for personal gain or benefit of the shareholder putting it forward. Those are the two most common things, and that's the qualification that a shareholder needs to have in order to be able to put forward a proxy.
Which people or groups are most often putting forward the shareholder proposals at this point in time?
Well, historically, it's been institutional investors, and that is still the case. And there are several reasons for that. Even though the thresholds are low, that $2,000 held for a year, that's the logistical threshold. The actual threshold is much higher, And that's because of the way companies respond. Companies almost always will challenge a shareholder proposal before the SEC in a quasi-legal proceeding. They'll cite the chapter and verse of Section 14A8 as to why a proposal can be legitimately omitted from the proxy. And unless a shareholder has good representation or is adept themselves at defending against these kinds of challenges, they sort of get washed to the side. But the institutions historically have been the faith-based organizations represented by ICCR, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. And ICCR, they really created the South African divestiture movement 43 years ago and have been at the forefront of this part of the social investment movement ever since. We do see a lot more endowments and foundations getting into the game because they're realizing that they're donating money to try and solve a societal or environmental problem. And if they turn around and look in their endowment portfolios, they realize they own shares of companies that are creating some of the very same problems that they are directly trying to solve, that is their mission to address. We call it using the 95% to support the 5%, because there's a 5% giving rule in the endowment world where 5% of the corpus has to go out every year. But if that 5% is going for good, but the 95% is causing the bad, there's a real disconnect there. So we see more and more foundations and endowments and philanthropic entities getting involved in this way. And then, of course, you have your public pension funds, the state and municipal funds, the universities, and so forth are getting involved now in a very big way.
Would you now give an overview of the highlights of the 2013 proxy season? Which topics have been most emphasized?
Yeah, I think probably the most important topic this year continues to be political spending by corporations. And there were 125 resolutions that were filed on this topic, which was really a third of the total of all resolutions filed. 51 of those were on transparency of lobbying spending, and that's up from 40 resolutions on that topic last year. You know, it's really an issue of shareholder concern where we see a Harvard Law study coming out that says not only does heavy political spending correlate with financial underperformance, the professor who published that study argues that it's actually a causal relationship and not just a correlation. You know, we just see too often that political spending by a corporation becomes an executive perk, where one or two guys at the top get to choose how millions of dollars that rightfully belong to shareholders get spent. And they tend not to have to justify to shareholders as to why they're doing this spending. So asking for transparency so that shareholders know where the money is going and the public knows where the money is going is consistent with the Supreme Court Citizens United case, which actually assumed that there would be transparency of this sort of thing. And it's just a way for us to respond to what we see as just huge amounts of dark money sloshing into the political system, which is very, very unhealthy.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Bruce Herbert, Chief Executive, and Larry Doors, Vice President of Newground Social Investment. Our topic is shareholder advocacy and progress made toward creating positive change in publicly traded corporations during the 2013 proxy season. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org.
And if I could just continue a little bit on the political spending topic, because it is so important. Now, about 120 publicly traded companies have agreed to disclose their political spending. We ourselves at Investor Voice had filed a resolution at Boeing. And I believe it was the sixth year that we had approached Boeing on this topic. And this year, finally, Boeing agreed to be transparent in any of its political spending. They said they had not been spending politically for the last year or two, that they had no intention to do so going forward, but if they did, they would be transparent about it. And most importantly, they wrote to each of the trade associations that they're part of and said, not one Boeing dollar shall be spent for political purposes. And they received confirmation in writing from each of those associations. And it's particularly important, for instance, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce spent more than $32 million during the 2012 election cycle on advertisements in the political realm. So that's where most of the money is slipping into the system, is through these sorts of trade associations and so-called social welfare groups. So we feel very good about Boeing joining the other 120 companies who have sort of stepped out of the game. And the most interesting thing, I think, is that there was a lawsuit, for instance, in January that was filed by the New York State Common Retirement Fund against Qualcomm. And New York said, look, you know, this is germane information. We need to know what your political spending is. And within a month, Qualcomm settled, agreed, and went ahead and acted to disclose their political spending. So that's a big and interesting step. It didn't actually create a legal process yet, but it showed that companies feel as though they have a weak hand in standing up against that. And the third part of it is that the Securities and Exchange Commission is now looking at a draft rule to require all public companies to disclose their political spending. And I think that's where we're really going here. One of the things we see over time is when active and interested investors are bringing an issue over and over and over again, the SEC recognizes that this is an important and germane issue and moves to codify it, to make a rule around it. And so with a little luck and with some support from the public, we feel as though we can see this new rule and we can move on to other topics.
It really has been moving from an issue of shareholder concern to an issue of regulatory concern, as evidenced by the discussion at the SEC with a new head of the SEC, by the way. And Larry mentioned 120 companies have actually adopted pretty thoroughgoing disclosure requirements. 16 of those were just this past year in the last proxy season. And 60 of those companies are in the S&P 100. So 60% of the largest trend-setting companies in America have adopted these kind of forward-looking good corporate governance strategies. And lastly, the Conference Board, perhaps America's preeminent business organization, has a handbook on corporate political disclosure and codifies these same things that are now being looked at by the SEC. And as well, there is now an index of corporate transparency around political disclosure that ranks companies across the board as to how well they are doing in this arena. So the scrutiny is there, the shareholder sentiment is there, the public awareness is there, the regulatory environment is now really coming to the fore. So it really has been the biggest topic of this year and probably will be for at least another year until something concrete comes through the SEC.
The organization 350.org has proposed divestment from fossil fuel stocks as a way of helping to address climate change. What is your view of divestment from fossil fuel companies as a strategy to address climate change?
Well, we think it can be a very effective strategy, but it does need to be understood. Put into more historical context, we mentioned a moment ago the South African divestiture movement. And divestiture was selling of companies, but there was a much larger and more compelling component to that movement, which was the selective purchasing aspect. And so to put the two in contrast to each other, if a university, for instance, tells any one of its vendors, you know, if you are doing business in the case of South Africa, if you're doing business in South Africa, we're not going to do business with you, that directly affects that company's wallet. And that caused companies to pull out of South Africa in droves. And the ending of those activities in South Africa is what dried up the purse strings to the apartheid regime and really brought them to their knees and brought them to the table. And the divestment, that same university selling shares out of their portfolio, helped to publicize and make more people aware of what was going on. They had sort of a bully pulpit, being a university or any other type of large public entity. So it's an important tool, and it's important to use, like most tools, you know, a hammer by itself is not much use. You also need the nail, and you also need the marking tools to get the right placements and so forth. So like most tools, you need other tools to make it most effective. And putting those two in context, that's how we view divestment.
I think it's important for a couple of reasons. First of all, to understand exactly what do you mean when you talk about fossil fuel divestment, because in some places they talk about the filthy 15, the 15 companies with the most fossil fuels still in the ground, and also a list of 200 companies. But those 200 companies, again, are really focused on the assets, on the coal, oil, and natural gas that are underground that are controlled by those companies. And they don't necessarily include some of the companies like Halliburton, for instance, that people would naturally associate with this. So number one, you have to be very specific about what do you mean when you're talking about fossil fuel divestment. And then to be clear on the goals. And as Bruce mentioned, you know, the goal of raising awareness, 350.org has done a fantastic job. Some people have expressed the feeling that if everybody would get together and divest their oil stocks, we would drive the price down of those stocks. And that, unfortunately, is just completely unrealistic.
It's also not the goal of 350.org.
Right.
We met with Bill McKibben when he was here in Seattle recently and talked over this in detail. And his goal in calling for divestment is an awareness goal. It's not the idea that if everybody did it at one time, it would drive the stock price down. Now, there are other reasons why the valuation levels might go down, you know, as a result of carbon tax impositions and things that would devalue the reserves in the ground, but it's not the selling of stock by individuals or even institutions and universities.
Yeah, I mean, even if every university sold every share all at once, every university endowment across the country all at once sold all of their fossil fuel stocks, it would amount to 0.4% of the value of those stocks, and that's simply not enough to affect the stock price by itself. But I do think, you know, we've been involved with the University of Washington and the conversations that are taking place there, and it's very interesting, and I hope that people pay attention to that. And talking with the student groups and encouraging them, as Bruce was talking about, to look at selective contracting. You know, there are rating agencies that talk about which oil and gas companies are less bad, essentially, than others. And there might be a way when the University of Washington is purchasing gasoline, for instance, to say we will prefer to buy from companies in the top quintile of the ratings. And so we want to create this idea that companies are trying to compete to get into that quintile. And if universities across the country said, you know, we're only going to buy from the better oil companies, that really could have a very, very powerful effect. So we're hoping that this conversation started by 350.org can lead to a whole variety of effective tactics.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Bruce Herbert, Chief Executive, and Larry Doors, Vice President of Newground Social Investment. Our topic is shareholder advocacy and progress made toward creating positive change in publicly traded corporations during the 2013 proxy season. In the end, what do you think that divestment from fossil fuel companies is likely to accomplish?
That's an interesting question, because there's a short and a long, and there's almost never an end. In the short term, you know, awareness, as we referenced, is the key part of it. But over the longer term, the divestment, what starts as perhaps a statement, will end up being an investment strategy. Because as the realization of the figures that 350.org has brought forward, as the realization that the valuation levels of these types of companies and their fossil fuel reserves in the ground, those reserves are going to be devalued, that significantly deflates the values of the companies. And so what now might be done on a, what you could describe as a principled basis, you know, I think in the future will be done because it will no longer be good economic sense to be investing in companies like that.
Yeah, I think you can look at the coal company stocks, which have not performed well because coal is just recognized as a very dirty fuel and one that the industry is trying to move away from, that the regulatory bodies are trying to move us away from. And oil and gas stocks could very well be next. And so people talk about the carbon bubble, that in fact we're overvaluing these fuels that we're really not going to be able to dig up and burn. And so when that is reflected in the stocks of the companies that control those fuel assets, that should drive the value of the stocks down. And so those who have moved out of owning those stocks will, on a relative basis, benefit from that.
You mentioned the University of Washington. Would you also comment on the city of Seattle's divestment efforts?
It's to be applauded, but to be honest, the mayor's office really is not in a position to control the decisions around most of the money that the city of Seattle has invested. Most of that is controlled by the pension board. So when the mayor made his announcement, it was a good thing, but it really only affected a very small number of dollars and was really much more symbolic than actual. That said, I think it's reasonable for the community to look to the pension board and have some expectations and ask some questions and expect transparency. which in the past we haven't gotten a whole lot of from that particular group.
But the city does have a megaphone, a bully pulpit. The city taking that action and that step is an important one that we want to celebrate.
So what is the likely effect on the portfolio of institutions that might decide to divest from fossil fuels?
Well, that is an interesting question, and there are a couple of published studies, one from Aperio Group and one from Advisor Partners, that find that it would have a negligible effect overall on people's portfolio in terms of the performance. Really negligible. Now, the University of Washington Treasurer's Office did their own study, and this was based on the assumption that there will be no change in regulation around carbon, and they found that about 0.2% lower performance would be expected. And I think that there's reason to question that assumption that there's not going to be any changes in regulation going forward.
What do you see as the relative role of shareholder advocacy compared to divestment from fossil fuel companies in addressing climate change?
Well, they are different tools, and they go hand in hand, and they actually can be used in conjunction in a very effective way. We've seen a number of organizations over the years, and even today, who will divest in a principled way of a company or an industry. So let me give an example. Healthcare systems will routinely have a screen against tobacco holdings. And yet those same companies that have a very principled stand against holding tobacco because of the really detrimental health impacts will carve off a small portion of their portfolio that they call an advocacy portfolio and will own just enough shares under the SEC rules to qualify for filing shareholder proposals. And that way, they can take the principled stand of divestment and then also be a voice in the shareholder meetings, even filing shareholder resolutions that bring to light some of the practices of these companies, which helps forward the mission end.
And I think we can probably expect that the University of Washington will take this step as a first measure, and that is to begin to file some shareholder resolutions. You know, this year we saw the first resolution that was filed at Chevron asking for the company to provide a report on risk exposure around climate change and really to put right in front of shareholders these issues and the possibility that because of regulatory change around the world, that they will not be able to draw on the oil and gas that they control that's in the ground right now. So getting transparency around that, getting companies to have to speak honestly to their shareholders about that, I think is something that the shareholder advocates can contribute to this discussion, and then public pressure will continue to grow.
How have fossil fuel companies responded so far to the divestment efforts?
Well, as you expect from the largest corporations in the world, they've dried up like a leaf and blown away with a puff of wind. No, there's been an array of different responses. One interesting one is the American Petroleum Institute brought forward a report that was done by two consultants that found, quote unquote, that oil and natural gas stocks, but note, not including coal stocks, had outperformed other asset classes during a couple of different selected time periods. What's interesting about that is how you can take almost any set of data and find a time period or some slice and dice of it that makes it look good. And we're talking about, of course, 350.org is talking about fossil fuels. And so then to conveniently carve off coal and talk about the financial returns of only these other elements is disingenuous and misleading, really. But that's the sort of thing that we expect from the fossil fuel companies by and large.
And the straight story is that the people who are leading these efforts at the fossil fuel companies, many of them come right out of the tobacco denial industry. They're the same people who fought for years to say that the science on the harm from tobacco is inconclusive. So that's the playbook that they're playing from.
To what extent have fossil fuel companies responded so far to efforts by shareholder advocates to address climate change?
It's still a little early yet. There have been some fairly effective resolutions asking for greenhouse gas reduction targets, and those have been getting quite strong support because people do recognize that this is a very important approach. So some companies have been coming around, setting those targets, talking about how they're going to reach those targets. And some companies continue to resist, but there's a lot of strength. You know, even at Chevron or ExxonMobil, we're talking 25 to 30% of the share owners are saying, we want this. So I think that it continues to grow stronger, and this may be where we begin to see the separation between the better and the worse within that industry.
You know, Investor Voice filed a proposal this year and also in 2011 at Berkshire Hathaway. Now, Berkshire Hathaway is a unique company. They're organized as an insurance company, but they hold a variety of different industries, one of which is a major electric utility, Mid-American Energy. And Mid-American, some substantive portion of their generating capacity comes from coal. Also, Berkshire owns Burlington Northern, and people have speculated that Burlington Northern was bought to be able to transport coal, not only for Berkshire's own holdings, but also with these coal export terminals that are being slated for various places along the West Coast, including, of course, we know here in Washington State. And one of our strategies with going to Berkshire Hathaway was that to bring other voices into the debate, because if the insurers of companies are saying, your activities, we are concerned, are going to give rise to liability that we'll have to bear, so either we're not going to insure you anymore or we're going to have to increase your premium. It's one thing if community members are outside the locked gates, you know, making noise. It's quite another if shareholders are standing up inside the annual meeting being owners of companies. It's another yet again if the people who bank these companies and the people who insure them are raising these self-same issues. And so it's a very important larger strategy that we're embarked on here.
How can individuals who own individual stocks or mutual funds best help address climate change through their investments? Is it better to divest from fossil fuel stocks or own the stocks and vote their proxies?
Well, first of all, you know, I think in general, look to the social investment movement and join that movement. If you own your stocks directly and you want to go ahead and hold them, then you have a responsibility to vote your shares. You get rights and responsibilities when you own something. So, you know, you should vote your shares. There are opportunities to do so. If you own them directly and you decide to sell your shares, put it on Facebook. Tell everybody that you're doing it and why you're taking that step and invite others to join you. Be loud and come right out and talk about it. If you own your shares through an institution, say a mutual fund company or a retirement plan, and choose to hold them, then go ahead and tell your manager or your advisor or the person who comes to talk to you about your 401k, tell them that you want that company to vote on your behalf in favor of, say, greenhouse gas reduction targets. And if you hold through an institution and decide you want to sell, say what you're doing and say why. You know, make a splash about it. Don't just quietly go into the night. But it's a real opportunity, and each of us is the media for our own communities. And to speak out and be the media for the people who know you and trust you, and tell them what you're doing and tell them why.
And two other points, of course, an individual can adopt the same strategy as some of the largest institutions and divest on the whole, but hold enough shares to qualify them to either go to the annual meeting, which is even a single share will allow you to attend an annual meeting. Of course, you want to pick one that you're either going to that vicinity anyway or is local, otherwise you have an airplane flight, which is not good for greenhouse gas. But the other point is, in addition to having an advocacy position, is to look not just at the investments you own, but look at where you own your investments. So if you're investing through a mutual fund company whose own political contributions are going to support the status quo and to advance things that you don't believe in, then change your investment company. You know, go from mutual fund A to maybe a socially motivated mutual fund company. Look at one of the Merrill Lynch's of the world, the number two lifetime contributor to the George W. Bush campaigns. If you pull your money out of them, your fees, your commissions, even just your assets under management aren't going to support their view of the world as represented by lobbyists that they do have crawling around Capitol Hill. So individuals can be involved in large ways and small, and all of it matters. The impact is even better when you make yourself heard.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Terrific. Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Diane.
You were just listening to Bruce Herbert, Chief Executive, and Larry Doors, Vice President of Newground Social Investment. For more information, check on the web at newground.net and also investorvoice.net. Again, that's newground.net and investorvoice.net. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on Listener Power at 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.